Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Orlando Espin, professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego and director of San Diego's Center for the Study of Latino Catholicism. He'll speak on the topic, The People of God, the Inescapable and Upsetting Presence of Culture in Ecclesiology. Dr. Espin's remarks were given as the 13th Annual Lawler Lecture in Theology, which was named to honor Michael G. Lawler, Professor Emeritus of Catholic Theology at Creighton. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John O'Keefe, Director of the Center for Catholic Thought at Creighton University.
Good evening, and welcome to the 13th Annual Lawler Lecture in Theology. I'm John O'Keefe. I am the Director of the Center for Catholic Thought here at Creighton, which is the new home of the Lawler Lecture Series. Before I introduce our speaker this evening, I'd like to say a few words about the Lawler Lecture itself. The lecture series is named to honor Michael G. Lawler, the Professor Emeritus of Catholic Theology at Creighton. Lawler joined Creighton as a systematic theologian in 1970. He served as chair of the Department of Theology several times, as president of the university faculty twice, and as dean of the graduate school from 1985 until 1995. In 1981, he received the Distinguished Faculty Award, and in 1997, the Dean's Award for Excellence in Research. He retired in 2005, but is still very much active in his field and in this series. Tonight, though, I have the distinct honor to introduce to you Professor Orlando Espin, who is Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Diego, where he also directs the Interdisciplinary Center for the Study of Latino-Latina Catholicism. Dr. Espin completed the dual doctorate in systematic and practical theology at the Pontifical Catholic University in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. He has specialized in the theological study of popular Catholicism, as well as in theologies of culture and tradition. He is regarded as one of the founders of U.S. Latino-Latina Catholic theology. Espin is also engaged in ecumenical discussions among Latino and Latina Catholic and Protestant theologians, and is the initiator of the first ever interreligious dialogue among Latino, Latina Catholic, and Afro-Lucumi theologians. Professor Espin is the author or editor of 9 books, including The Faith of the People, Theological Reflections on Popular Catholicism. Co-edited an award-winning dictionary of theology and religious studies, and he has published over 300 articles in U.S., European, and Latin American academic journals, and more than 50 book chapters. He has received several national and international awards for his theological work on popular Catholicism and on the theological importance of culture, including an honorary doctorate and an honorary professorship. He has twice been elected president of the Academy of Catholic Hispanic Theologians of the United States. Professor Espin was the first Latino elected to the board of directors of the Catholic Theological Society of America, and he founded and was the first chief editor of the Journal of Hispanic Latino Theology. He has served as various roles in the Hispanic Theological Initiative and in the Hispanic Summer Program of Theology and Religion. Professor Espin is also very active in the American Academy of Religion, where he currently serves on the editorial board of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. On a more personal note, and I'm sure that he does not remember, but I met Professor Espin many years ago as a young professor here at Creighton when I traveled to San Diego for the annual meeting of the Catholic Theological Society in the company of Dr. Mary Ann Stevens, who is now the president of the College of St. Mary, but who was at the time the department chair of the theology department here at Creighton. And Professor Espine was the local representative of the CTSA and was escorting us around, showing us all the delights of San Diego. I remember distinctly one evening going out to dinner with Professor Esteem and Mary Ann Stevens, and I was reminded this evening with Gail Risch. We ordered some wine, and it was a beautiful restaurant overlooking the city of San Diego. Professor Esteem took a sip, looked around, and said, as only a theologian could, "All this and eternal life." Please join me in welcoming Professor Orlando Espine as he speaks to us on the topic, "The People of God, the Inescapable and Upsetting Presence of Culture in Ecclesiology."
I just told him I will take him to that same restaurant again. Now you have to go with your wife. Yeah. All right. So if you're familiar with San Diego, it's in Horton Plaza on top. So thank you for the welcome and for your kind words. I start by again thanking Professor Michael Lawler for the invitation to be with you tonight, and for the annual lecture in theology that honors his work and his thought. So it is an honor to honor you. I also thank your university and its theology department, currently chaired by an alumnus of my institution. Much that is good is being done here, and you have every reason to be proud of your department. Professor Lawler asked me to reflect on ecclesiology and specifically on what the growing Latino presence in the American Catholic Church might imply for American ecclesiology. But before we start, let me clarify two terms because not everybody might be a theologian in this room or know ethnic identity questions. By Latino or Latina, I mean the U.S. population of Latin American ancestry. I do not mean, therefore, Latin Americans. Okay? So the comparative term would be Irish American, German American, Italian American. All right? So we're, instead of Latino Americans, which of course can be misunderstood as Latin American, we're Latino. If we're males, Latinas. If we're females, or Latinoa, as we're coming to pronounce that term, which is the only way to make it inclusive. All right? Second, the term ecclesiology refers to a theological discipline. And this theological discipline studies the church as the object of its study. All kinds of things about it. So when I say ecclesiology, that's what I'm referring to. Okay? And the caveat expected from any academic, please be aware that I will not be able to mention and explain in this presentation all that would need to be said or explained in a thorough examination of the questions and issues raised here. So therefore, don't expect more than an introduction to questions. Okay? A little preamble. The second chapter of Lumen Gentium, which is the Second Vatican Council's dogmatic constitution on the church, is dedicated to an understanding of the church as the people of God. The expression people of God is such a biblically and doctrinally evident expression that we often disregard, quote, its Copernican consequences, as the famous Yves Congar once called. He's famous in theology, at least. At times, we also forget that the adjective the Second Vatican Council most frequently connected to the phrase people of God is the adjective pilgrim. In other words, the pilgrim people of God is the expression more frequently used by Vatican II to refer to the church. Pilgrim, people, and certainly of God. The meanings of those terms, however, are not so evident today. Can one be a pilgrim, for example, without very really moving? Therefore, and furthermore, can we be a human people without being in a culture? Doesn't the grace of God build on who and what we are as humans? Those questions lead me to the following. To the following question. Why would Latino Catholics be important for an American Catholic ecclesiology? Among other reasons, as we're going to see tonight, I hope, because most Latino Catholics are American, because most Latinos already are nearly half of all American Catholics, and because Latinos might be reminding all American Catholics that the most basic definition of church rests on the insight that all of us are one pilgrim people of God. But let's start with demographic facts. So first part, who are U.S. Latino Catholics? The Latino population is the fastest growing segment of the U.S. Catholic Church and of U.S. society as a whole. That's a fact. All the figures I'll be using here come from the U.S. Census Bureau and or from statistical research conducted by the National Council of Hispanic Catholic Ministries or by the University of San Diego's Center for the Study of Latino Catholicism. So let's start with statistics. In 1950, there were approximately 2.3 million Latinos in the U.S. By the year 2000, 50 years later, this number had grown to 35.5 million, and today there are about 50 million Latinos in the U.S. In 2000, there were 35.5 million Latinos. In 2010, 10 years, that number went to 50 million. The U.S. Census Bureau calculates that before 2040, there will be more than 110 million Latinos in this country. And before 2025, one of every four Americans will be Latino, even if immigration were to stop today. From 1970 to 2000, the number of Latino Catholics increased by over 20 million, or 264%. This increase accounted for 86% of all growth in the U.S. Catholic Church during that 30-year period. 86% of all growth. Today, it is estimated that approximately 48-point-something% of all Catholics in the U.S., so statistically half, are Latinos. All projections indicate that before 2020, more than 51% of all U.S. Catholics will be Latino, even if immigration stopped. 41% of all Latino adults are under the age of 30. 30% are between the ages of 30 and 40. And 21% are older than 40. Overall, therefore, Latinos are much younger than all non-Latino groups in the country. Guess who's having the kids? A recent study found that 55% of all U.S. Catholics under the age of 30 already are Latino. In 1999, a report by the Louisville Institute to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said, quote, "Given the fact that the Latino population is overwhelmingly young, the church ignores Latino youth at its own peril," end of quote. Most Latinos live in large cities. In 9 of the 10 largest cities in the U.S., ethnic minorities now constitute the majority of the population, with Latinos being the largest minority in 7 of these 10 largest cities. Overall, Latinos accounted for 62% of the population increase in the nation's 100 largest cities between 1990 and 2000. Latinos, however, have less access to education than either non-Latino whites or blacks. Among Latinos, Mexican Americans have the least amount of education of the three major Latino subgroups. In 2005, 87% of non-Latinos over the age of 24 had a high school degree, compared to only 30% of Mexican Americans, 65% of Puerto Ricans, and 86% of Cuban Americans. This specifically affects professional Catholic theology, because only about 3% of all Catholic theologians are Latinos, while Latino Catholics comprise nearly half of the church and will, in a few years, become the vast majority of American Catholicism. Therefore, American Catholic theology, given these statistics, is dangerously approaching a situation of becoming culturally irrelevant for the soon-to-be majority of American Catholics. And that is a problem. But more demographic statistics. The U.S. Census Bureau's recent population report found that 11 million Latinos were foreign-born, comprising only 22% of all Latinos. Therefore, the vast majority, 78% of all U.S. Latinos, are U.S.-born. Today, a caution is in order. The undocumented population in the U.S. cannot be perceived as only of Latin American origins, even though U.S. policy and public opinion seem fixated on equating undocumented with Latin American. Canada is the second largest producer of undocumented aliens. And some European, African, and Asian countries provide the U.S. with as many undocumented workers as Latin American countries, although it seems no one wants to pay attention to it. And now to religious statistics. There's some disagreement concerning the number of Catholics in the country, as well as the number of U.S. Latino Catholics. This latter question has two aspects. What proportion of U.S. Catholics is Latino, and what proportion of U.S. Latinos are Catholic? The Catholic population has usually been estimated at between 25 and 28% of the total U.S. population. In a recent Gallup poll on religious preference, 27% of the respondents self-identified, and this is important, self-identified as Catholic. This means, then, that there are approximately 76 million Catholics in the U.S., or at least people who so self-identify. However, when the estimate is based on parish participation or Sunday Mass attendance, the figure drops drastically, some studying suggesting that only 11% of U.S. Catholics go to Mass every Sunday. Statistical studies have frequently underrepresented the number of U.S. Catholics who are Latino, because most of these studies were conducted in English, and this means their findings underrepresented the true number of Latino Catholics, since about 35% of Latinos speak only or mainly Spanish. Recent larger and bilingual surveys have indicated that anywhere between 72 and 80% of all Latinos self-identify as Catholic, which would put the Latino membership within the Catholic Church at approximately 48% of the total. This further implies that non-Catholic Latinos, are approximately 20 to 28% of the total Latino population, a figure that seems to have remained stable since the 1990s. Non-Catholic Latinos, however, may not be simply identified with Protestant, Evangelical, or Pentecostal denominations, since a growing number of Latinos do not consider themselves members of any church or are members of non-Christian religions. And one further point. As the percentage of Latinos in the overall national population continues to increase, the overall percentage of Catholics in the U.S. will also continue to increase, since Latinos also account for 86% of all growth in the total U.S. Catholic Church's membership. And as a group, Latinos tend to be considerably younger than most other Catholics. And I remind you that this demographic future will hold even if immigration were to be completely stopped, because 78% of all Latinos were born in the U.S. Although Latinos are crucial to the future of the Catholic Church and its institutions in the U.S., young Latinos are even more so. This is because Latinos comprise half of all Catholics under age 30 already, and 65% of all Catholics under age 10. Today, in the nation's two most populous states, California and Texas, over 70% of all Catholics under the age of 30 already are Latino. U.S. Census Bureau statistics indicate that nationally, the Latino population between the ages of 15 and 29 grew 57%, while the non-Latino white population decreased by 11%. Meanwhile, again, according to the Census Bureau, the Latino population under the age of 10 increased by 66% compared to a 12% decrease in the number of non-Latino white population in the same age bracket. The Census Bureau reported that this trend will continue. Enough statistics. That's the first half. I think I have made the point that we have to wake up and smell the coffee. Second part, what does all of this mean for an American ecclesiology? Simply put, if it is true that the church is the pilgrim people of God, then who the people of God are demographically and culturally cannot be irrelevant to either the being of the church or to its self-understanding. In other words, who the real people of God really are is not and cannot be irrelevant to ecclesiology, because the people of God are not a theory. Demographics did not establish the church, but demographic changes have changed the church and the understanding it has and has had of itself, as 20 centuries of church history demonstrate beyond any doubt. The vast majority of Latinos, 78% as we saw, are not immigrants. But immigration is extremely important, is an extremely important reality to and among every Latino Catholic community. In other words, immigration is an extremely important issue or experience for at least half of the American Catholic Church. What would this do, then, for an American ecclesiology? Furthermore, it seems crucially important that ecclesiology be grounded on the reality and image of immigration, because all of us are immigrants into the reign of God. All of us are the migrating pilgrim people of God. And on this fundamental insight, we should be building every ecclesiology. The Latino presence in the American church today is God's latest reminder of the obvious. The Latino is the face of American Catholicism in the 21st century, and that is no longer in doubt. So we have to wake up, smell the coffee, and deal with it as Catholics, not as politicians. Anyone who has read the Hebrew and Christian scriptures knows that reflection on immigration is as old as the Bible, and arguably older. I quote from Leviticus 19. When a foreigner resides with you in your land, do not bother him. You shall treat the foreigner who resides with you no differently than those born among you. And you will love the foreigner as you love yourself. For you too were once foreigners in the land of Egypt, says the Lord your God. Why should American Catholic theologians, indeed, why should all Catholics, reflect dogmatically, that is, doctrinally, on immigration today? What does this have to do with our being and defining church today? Why pay dogmatic and not just pastoral attention to the Latino reality of the American church? There are a number of very important reasons, and let me just mention two out of the several which I consider to be necessary grounds on which to build an American Catholic ecclesiological reflection. The first ground is that there is no acultural ecclesiology or an acultural church. Scholars can argue about the most adequate description or definition of what is meant by culture as they attempt to discover common denominators among diverse shared styles of humanness in living human communities. I understand culture to be the historically shared means and ways through which a people unveil themselves to themselves, and only secondarily to others, as meaningfully human. The most basic means and ways for this unveiling are the social construction of reality and the discovery of meaning within and through that socially constructed reality. This brief description of culture would seem to imply many things. And among others, as I just mentioned above, there is the implication that no human society and no human individual can even dream of the possibility of existing without culture. We are in culture as in a womb from which there is no birth because we are already born into it. Obviously, cultures are not impermeable. They do change, grow, and even die. But in the very long history of cultures, individuals and communities never explain or view themselves except through the tools of understanding granted them by culture. These tools, as I call them, place certain limits on what can be affirmed as real, as good, as true, as factual, as beautiful, as possible, and so on. Although facilitating understanding, these tools also limit what is culturally possible, what culturally can be understood. The church is not immune to this role of culture. It is formed by individuals and communities of the most diverse cultural backgrounds. It would be nonsense to pretend that the cultures of its members have not affected the ways in which the church has understood the gospel and reflected upon it throughout the centuries. Besides being anthropological nonsense, this pretension would imply a practical denial of what is meant by the incarnation. Christ lived in a specific time period, in a specific land, within a concrete history, within a single culture. Jesus of Nazareth was a first century Palestinian Jew, and there is no way to responsibly understand him by disregarding these historical, geographical, and cultural facts. Modern biblical exegesis has more than sufficiently shown this to be true. And after Jesus, all Christians, without exception, have also lived in historical, geographical, and especially cultural milieu. All Christian preaching, all sacramental celebrations, all Christian witnessing and living, all Christian theologizing and doctrinal statements, and all shapes of the church throughout 20 centuries have occurred within specific cultural contexts that have, of necessity, acted as occasions and tools for Christian understanding, for Christian doctrine, life, and decision-making. Nothing human in Christianity is acultural. Nothing human in Christianity is without culture or outside of culture. Nothing. Only that is unlimited by culture in the church, which we also find unlimited by Christ's humanness, namely, the God of love and the love of God. This is why the gospel, which Christians believe to be ultimately the message of God, can be preached, believed, and lived in any human culture, because being God's, it transcends all cultures. But the way it is believed and lived is nevertheless humanly cultural. The ones who preach, believe, and live the gospel are human beings. And though the source of the gospel is not limited to culture, Christian human beings and communities are. Therefore, their way of being Christian and of understanding the reasons for it and the consequences of it will be necessarily cultural. There have never been a-cultural doctrines, a-cultural magisterial statements, a-cultural theologies, or a-cultural ethics, or a-cultural ministries, or a-cultural anything in Christianity. Not even a-cultural revelation. This implies many things, but for our purposes here, this centrality of culture means that the way individuals and communities humanize or dehumanize themselves is cultural. The way people are Christian and the shape their church will take at any given historical period is also cultural. The role of culture means for Christianity that the way a people or a person experientially perceive the love and grace of God and the way they respond to it in faith, conversion, etc., will always be cultural. In other words, there is no acultural Christianity, just as there is no acultural option for God, love, and salvation. Nevertheless, just as humans can dehumanize themselves, so can cultures. Cultures can bear the sinful imprint of the humans that create them. They do. Cultures, all cultures, are also dehumanized and dehumanizing and in need of the liberating love of God. All cultures need salvation, which leads me to say that, as a consequence, no culture can ever claim to be of itself or in comparison with other cultures better suited to incarnate the Christian message or better suited to theologically understand it, with all due respect to Germans. Grace as it is in itself, that is, God's eternal inner self as relational love, is not bound by culture. But grace as it is for and within us, which is the only grace we can experience, can only show itself as cultural, because we are cultural. If God as grace in itself is eternally transcending history and culture, God as grace for and within us would be utterly meaningless and beyond our perception and experience, except as that grace entered our creaturely world, worked through and within our histories and our cultures, and molded itself to our cultural understandings, making it possible for us to see and touch the gracious actions of the God who is for us. Catholic ecclesiology has typically considered the church's identity and mystery to be grounded on God's grace. But because God's grace is only experienced culturally by us, then the church cannot possibly be church aculturally. Given the historical changing character of our cultures, then the experience and shape of the church must also be changing, adapting, and molding themselves to our diversity. Thus, what might be perceived as a graced ecclesial moment in one place at one time and for one group of people might be perceived as a disgrace in and for another. God's will must include our cultural dimension, since we cannot be human without culture. And God's will is that we be human. Or put another way, it must be the will of God that each of us humanize him or herself in the manner in which we are human, and that manner is specifically cultural. Therefore, to trample on the culture of a human group, therefore, might imply a denial and rejection of God's grace. Furthermore, it could prevent the trampled-on human group from perceiving and responding to the love of God for them. Colonization in the name of evangelization is simply not acceptable. When the overwhelming majority of the people of God today in this world are poor, marginalized, non-European in culture, etc., etc., can ecclesiology honestly pretend that it can adequately understand and express the meaning of being church while disregarding the faith and faith experience of the vast majority of the church. The church is not a theory. It is a living people. Or while nearly absolutizing, as some ecclesiologists do, ecclesial expressions of or understandings born in and for cultures that no longer exist. When half of the Catholic Church in the U.S. today is culturally and demographically Latino, can American ecclesiology pretend that it can adequately understand and express the meaning and being of American Catholicism while disregarding the faith and faith experience of the majority of the church? Could American ecclesiology be crafted differently, for crying out loud? Are we so colonized that we cannot create something that is truly American as the American church exists, not as we dream it? We should further remember that there are also millions of Asian American and Native American Catholics, as well as millions of Black Catholics. We forget that today there are more African American Catholics than there are Catholics in Ireland. When will the real minority recognize that it is part of a bigger whole? And no longer, if it ever was, the self-appointed mainstream. When will American Catholic theology and Catholic ministers wake up to the present demographic and cultural facts that are shaping the real future? The second ground on which to build an American Catholic ecclesiological reflection: the church is the pilgrim, emphasis on pilgrim, pilgrim people of God. Can we do American ecclesiology today and ignore immigration for the reason I mentioned earlier? For half the church, it is a crucial experience. The Catholic Church, as clearly taught by the Second Vatican Council, is a pilgrim church, a pilgrim people, a people on the move. These images are not poetic phrases. They indicate a reality that lies at the very foundations of Catholicism, of its sacramental approach and its understanding of reality, and of its very experience of the Trinitarian God. In other words, it is impossible to be Catholic and be stuck in the past or in the present. Catholicism journeys forward toward a still unknown future as a living witness to the precarious and always penultimate quality of all human societies, of all human explanations, of all human expectations, and of all human institutions. Indeed, it is part of the genius and of the essence of Catholicism to value that which is truly human while at the same time critiquing its claims to finality. Only God is final and absolute, and nothing else, not even the church, can make such claims. This double genius of Catholicism, to join and appreciate and to critique the claims to finality, this double genius of Catholicism has managed to push the church always forward without losing its foundational roots. The image of a pilgrim people, therefore, is not just a poetic phrase, but touches the very core of who we are as Catholics. However, can one be on a pilgrimage without ever moving? Can a people move into the future without somehow becoming immigrants into that very future? Can we do Catholic theology or Catholic ministry without therefore somehow reflecting on the meaning of migrating from the known to the unknown? Can we be Catholic without ourselves becoming immigrants into the future of humankind, a future not ours but God's? Can we be Catholic, therefore, without becoming immigrants in the reign of God? Can there be any Catholic ecclesiology that disregards the reign of God and the God of the reign as the sole future of the church and as the ultimate criteria for its present? Theological dogmatic reflection on immigration is not just for those or about those who are sociological immigrants or the children of immigrants. It is not just for those or about those who are pastorally engaged with immigrants and their families. It is and must be part and parcel of what Catholic theologians and ministers do. and what all Catholics believe. Indeed, if these theologians and ministers are American, a further reason is the very definition of Americanness. Can we understand ourselves as a nation if we forget our nation's immigrant reality? Not just the past, but its present reality as well. Can we understand the American experiment without incorporating into that understanding the theological and historical categories of pilgrimage, future, and immigration? The global economy is a reality whether we like it or not. The global labor market is a reality whether we like it or not. The global distribution of symbolic and material products is a reality whether we like it or not. Go on Facebook, smell the coffee. Global mass culture is an increasing reality. Global migrations of people provoked and sustained by globalization of the economy is also a fact that will not go away. And as a consequence, identity is no longer necessarily tied to a geographic location for an ever-growing number of people throughout the planet. People migrate today mostly because they want to find employment in order to feed their families, educate their children, and be able to retire during their golden years. Study after study has shown that the immense majority of immigrants want work, not a handout. Indeed, most American families today trace their own roots to people who migrated to the U.S. for exactly those reasons, those very honorable reasons. The reasons for migrating are not selfish, not dishonest, or irrelevant. In Catholic social doctrine, they are considered God-given rights. God-given. No nation, no government gives these rights. God, and God alone, does. The earth belongs to God, not to human governments. We have, therefore, the God-given right to work, to feed our families, to educate our children, and so on. This is official church teaching. Third part, I'm almost getting to the end. We have to take Catholicity seriously. We have already seen, on the one hand, that we must acknowledge the significance and reality of being a pilgrim people as foundational to Catholicism. And on the other hand, we must recognize the inescapable cultural reality of grace, love, faith, and church. Both of these realities should make us understand that we are urgently in need of a new ecclesiology that would take seriously the experience of and doctrinal issues raised by both culture and migrating. But while we consider that new ecclesiology, I would recommend that we also let a renewed understanding of Catholicity guide and ground the reflection. Ever since the councils of Christian antiquity, Catholic doctrine has consistently taught that the Church must recognize itself as both Catholic and one. There is no choice possible between these two marks of the Church. Catholicity and unity are non-negotiable and are equally necessary and important. History reminds us, however, that there is no easy way of fostering both Catholicity and unity. Catholicity, meaning universality as we know, is not about geography. In other words, the Catholicity of the Church does not depend on the latter's presence in every corner of the planet. If this were so, how could we claim that earliest Christianity was indeed already Catholic? Catholicity is not a question of physical, geographic, territorial presence. It is a necessary quality of the Church. A quality that describes a constitutive and indispensable dimension of the Church's mission and foundational grace. Catholicity has to do with universality as quality, as attitude, as vocation. The Church is Catholic because its doors are open to every human being and to every human group, without distinctions and without barriers built by humans. Baptism, not passports, are the door. The Church is Catholic because it refuses to assume that one human culture is superior to others, or that one human culture or nation is better suited as witness or bearer of the Christian gospel. Indeed, it is part of the very definition of Catholicity that national, cultural, racial, political, ethnic, gender, and economic barriers, and all the other barriers you can think of, must come down as a direct consequence of God's revelation in Christ. Catholicity does not stamp out diversity. That's not my original. That's in the Gospel. Catholicity does not stamp out diversity, however. On the contrary, it assumes the legitimacy of diversity. Universality does not necessitate uniformity, but it does require the end of prejudice and of all claims of superiority over others. Catholicity and unity are not synonyms of colonization or abuse. In some ways, it is possible to argue that Catholicity offers the Church the theological ground on which to understand and engage contemporary globalization, while at the same time allowing the Church to prophetically critique globalization, sometimes in human consequences. There where globalization attempts to erase diversity, Catholicity can strongly support it. There where globalization would implement unfair power and class relations, Catholicity can demand equality and respect for the rights of all humans. Indeed, the Church's Catholicity can play this prophetic role precisely because the Church, too, is a global community whose identity does not depend on nationalities, territories, borders, racial categories, or any other category that could serve as barrier, but whose reality, in the Church's reality, incorporates them all as equals. The Church is a community where all cultures and all peoples are welcome as equals, without being asked in the name of God or gospel to submit to cultural destruction or rape. It is indeed part of the genius of Catholicism to engage and dialogue with every culture, every race, every people, every idea. The Church will not necessarily come to agree with all, but agreement or disagreement cannot occur without prior discernment, and discernment cannot happen without prior knowledge. Knowledge, in turn, cannot come about without sincere engagement and an exchange. Those occasions when the Church unfortunately became persecutor and not dialogue partner were moments when discernment was based on prejudice and not on the necessary prior engagement and exchange with human cultures and ideas. The Catholicity of the Church transcends and critiques the barriers established by human societies, even those established by the Church itself throughout the centuries. Precisely because Catholicity assumes and engages human diversity as a gift from God. As I have often told my students, our doctrines and our theologies have to catch up to the God who is compassion and not the other way around. Welcoming the stranger, the immigrant, or the different, as we would say today, is the most often repeated commandment in the Hebrew Scriptures, with the exception of the imperative to worship only the one God. The love of neighbor, especially of the most vulnerable neighbor, is doubtlessly the New Testament's constant and most repeated demand. Further and concomitantly, Catholic social teaching has consistently defended not only the human rights of immigrants, but their right to migrate across borders in order to find security or employment. Whatever the cause of immigration today, there is no doubt as to where the official doctrines of the Catholic Church stand when it comes to defending the immigrant. And now to conclude. Three very important questions to guide and ground a new ecclesiological construct. I have just mentioned that Catholicity is a necessary quality of the Church, a quality that describes a constitutive and indispensable dimension of the Church's mission and foundational grace, a quality grounded in openness to the other. I also said that the Church is Catholic because its doors are open to every human being and to every human group, without distinction and without barriers. Here are three theological, dogmatic questions which might ground and guide the construction of a fundamental American Catholic ecclesiology. First, given the present-day context of globalization, could we not argue that immigration is today the indispensable sacrament or effective symbol of the Church's Catholicity? Can we have today Catholic universality if we reject immigrants? Second, can we be Catholic without recognizing in ourselves and in our immigrant neighbor the pilgrim condition so emphatically taught by the Bible and by the Second Vatican Council, thereby making immigration a contemporary definition of the pilgrim church, with all the latter implies and should imply in Catholic ecclesiology for the spirituality, ministry, and institutionality of church? And third, can we not regard our cultures, all of our cultures, as the paramount effective symbols of our participation in the incarnation of the Son of God? Can we not see our cultures, all of our cultures, as the means through which God's grace chooses to reach out to us and the inescapable means through which we respond to God in faith? Can we then not see that a culturally sensitive and inclusive ecclesiology that truly cherishes the cultural reality and diversity of the demographically real people of God is a necessity if we are to credibly witness as Catholics to the gospel of Jesus, the enculturated Son of God? We're all cultural beings, whether we notice it or not. And immigration is not going to stop. And given contemporary globalization, it will not. Most theologians have been dealing with culture as perhaps a relativizing enemy of Christianity or as a mostly irrelevant issue to revelation, grace, and salvation. Theologians have typically dealt with immigration from the perspective of ethics, social or personal. And yet the questions posed by culture, the questions posed by immigration, are really first and foremost, not pastoral, in any other way, but dogmatic to the very self-understanding of the church. These questions will not go away and will only become more urgent and more complex as the demographic reality of the people of God continues to change and to a change where the European American and European will become a smaller and smaller and smaller minority within world Catholicism. I know that I have done nothing tonight but suggest that culture and immigration and their contemporary global context merit careful study on the part of theologians, and not just theologians, by any Catholic. I have made this suggestion because of the ongoing, undeniable transformation of American Catholicism thanks to the faith and lives of Latinos in the church. Without the real people of God, the church would not exist, except as a theoretical construct without reality. Who are the people of God, demographically and culturally, is as inescapably important to the church as the belief that the people of God are the church. We Catholics are a pilgrim people of God, migrating in search of a new life as immigrants into the reign of God, a reign in which none of us has nationality or citizenship rights, except perhaps those whom we still crucify today. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the 13th Annual Lawler Lecture in Theology, which was named to honor Michael G. Lawler, Professor Emeritus of Catholic Theology at Creighton. We've heard a talk by Orlando Espin, Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of San Diego, and Director of San Diego's Center for the Study of Latino Catholicism. He spoke on the topic, The People of God, the Inescapable and Upsetting Presence of Culture in Ecclesiology. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 29, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.